My name is Gray Barker. I have just written a book called They Knew Too Much About Flying Saucers. This is not going to be a speech. This is not going to be a lecture. I'm just going to sit here in front of my tape recorder and talk to you quite informally. I'm making this recording on July 4, 1956. I'm here in my office today. I probably should be out having some fun. It's such a nice day. However, I had a great many things to do. I've been jumping around all over the country, making lectures, television appearances, radio talks, and so forth about my book. And as a result, on a holiday, I'm afraid I'm back at the office, hard at work. Perhaps I should tell you something about what I do before I get into some of the points I would like to bring out about my book and some of my experiences in investigating this phenomenon called flying saucers. I'm a businessman here in Clarksburg, West Virginia. I operate a film buying booking agency. I'm the seller who says what pictures are to be booked into certain theaters. I handle a number of theaters in this manner in West Virginia, Maryland, Virginia, and Ohio. All of this keeps me very busy. In fact, a lot of my business associates, when they pass me on the street and say hello, look at me as if they think, I wonder why that fellow is fooling around with such a subject that he claims to be investigating. A rather odd subject to these people, flying saucers. Well, sometimes seeing how the work piles up, I wonder myself why I ever got into this thing, as I'm sure a great many of you people listening often wonder too. A fellow called me up about a television appearance from New York recently. One of the first things he asked me was, did you ever see a flying saucer? Well, that is a very embarrassing question for me, for actually I have never seen anything that I could really interpret as a flying saucer. I surely would like to see one, and I'm still looking for them, but I haven't seen any. This person in New York on the other end of the line acted as if he were surprised that someone like myself, so interested in the subject, had never seen one. I told him that just because I had never seen one was certainly no reason that I should not discount the mounting pile of evidence that is accumulating for saucers, nor can I disbelieve the reliable people who say they have seen them. Perhaps my experiences in the field goes back, I would say, to 1952. In 1952, I suppose I was like a great many other people today, the man on the street, that is. I thought that flying saucers were the bunk, or perhaps I just didn't think too much of them at all at that time. At least I wasn't cognizant of everything that was going on. I was going about my daily life in a very normal way when all of a sudden something happened. I was sitting having breakfast, in fact. I picked up a newspaper and I saw a story written in my hometown, or what I call my hometown. It was written in Sutton, West Virginia. It was a United Press story. I'd like to quote you some of that story, if I might. Sutton, September 14, United Press. Seven Braxton County residents vowed today that a Frankenstein monster with D.O. drove them from a hilltop near here, but police figured the smelly boogeyman was a product of mass hysteria. The thing described by witnesses as half-man, half-dragon had not been reported seen since Friday night, but residents of the area said a foul odor still clung to the hilltop yesterday. All this started when Mrs. Kathleen May of Bud Woods, with she and six boys, one a 17-year-old National Guardsman, climbed the hill to investigate her two small sons' report that a flying saucer landed there. They said they found a fire-breathing monster 10 feet tall with a bright green body and a blood-red face that waddled toward them in a bouncing, floating motion and sent them scurrying down the hillside. She said the monster exuded an overpowering odor like metal that so sickened them they vomited for hours afterward. It looked worse than Frankenstein, said Mrs. May. It couldn't have been human. Well, naturally, I was a bit skeptical, at least after I read the story. For it did sound very much overwrought, and of course, it was, rather. But since this happened near my home, I was very curious about it. I have a farm near Flatwoods, West Virginia. In fact, I grew up in the country near there. Those people are very near to where my sister and brother live, near Flatwoods. So I thought I would go home and look around and try to find out what this was all about. I thought surely this must be a hoax of some sort. This must be cooked up. This just couldn't have happened, and I was determined to get at the bottom of it. Really, if something such as this were a hoax, it certainly deserved to be exposed, because a lot of people naturally were believing it. So I picked up my bags as soon as I could and departed for Sutton, which is the county seat, a little town near Flatwoods. Flatwoods really couldn't be considered a town. It's just a post office, a general store, and one or two other businesses. I arrived in Flatwoods late of an evening, and I found that the oldest boy, Gene Lemon, who was 17, and Mrs. May, the housewife, were in New York, where they would appear on the We the People television program, so I couldn't see them immediately. But the next day, I talked to the mayor of Sutton, and Mr. J. Holt Byrne, who also was editor of the Braxton Central, a weekly newspaper, and Mr. Byrne was ready to talk to Ivan Sanderson, whom I imagine some of you know about. Ivan Sanderson had come to Flatwoods to investigate the thing for a newspaper syndicate. Mr. Byrne had first thought surely this was a meteorite of some sort that threw off a lot of gases. It might have looked like a monster, but after thinking about it and interviewing some of the witnesses, he wasn't so sure. Well, because I'd known Mayor Byrne for a long time and knew he was a very level-headed fellow, I began to think also, well, maybe there is something to this. I'd better find out about it. Mr. Byrne told me that Neil Nunley, one of the seven witnesses, Neil Nunley was about 14 years old, he said the boy was a very level-headed fellow and could tell me just what he did see in a sensible manner. So, probably the next morning after I arrived, I went to Flatwoods. The boy wasn't there when I arrived, so I talked to his stepfather, a Mr. A.M. Jordan, who had seen an object come over the house before it landed on the hillside. He drew a picture of it for me, in fact, and at the time, he thought it was a jet plane when it went over, but of course, after talking with the boy, his stepson, he wasn't so sure. The Nunley boy came into the house after a while. He seemed to be a very serious-minded youngster. So I asked him to tell me just what he saw. I had my tape recorder there, and I do have some tapes I made on this investigation and on some other parts of the book. They knew too much about flying saucers. I do hope on some future tape to include excerpts from these tapes, but unfortunately I don't have on hand the kind of re-recording equipment necessary for such a thing, so I'll have to leave them out. But I'm sure if you heard some of these, you would be convinced, as I was, that these people were telling the truth. Anyway, the Nunley boy gave me a very complete story of just what had happened, just what he had seen, so I'm going to try to relate it to you. It was around 7 o'clock of an evening that day in September 1952. It was just getting dark. The shadows were beginning to come over the hills, and the kids were playing, incidentally, in a little ballpark near a schoolhouse. They were playing softball or baseball, something that the kids like to play anyway, when they looked up into the air, seeing something bright go overhead. The most peculiar thing about this object was that it seemed to land on the hilltop. It went over rather fast, and it slowed up, seemed to hover for a second, and then just seemed to fall down on top of the hill. Some of the children said it looked like a silver dollar going through the air. They were not all in complete agreement as to just what this looked like. Anyway, as nearly as I can reconstruct it, they believed it was a shooting star, which went over and had landed on the top of the hill. So, like most anyone who would be curious as to see what it was, they decided to go up to the hilltop and investigate. The playground is about a half a mile from the hill, so it was a little while before they arrived there. Mrs. Kathleen May lives at the base of this hill. They ran into her house and asked her to go with them. At first, she didn't believe there was anything to it all. She said, "Now, you're fibbing to me." But they said, "Well, come out onto the porch. I can, we can show you this thing on the hill. It's still lighted up there." So she went out on the porch, and she herself could see the light on the hill. This light seemed to be pulsating, dim to bright, dim to bright, in cycles. There were seven in this party, which went up to the hilltop, and Mrs. May, Jean Lemon, 17 years old, Neil Nunley, whom I interviewed at great length, who was 14 years old, Tommy Heyer, 10, Ronnie Shaver was also 10 years old, and Mrs. May's two children, Eddie and Fred, they were 13 and 12 years old, respectively. They naturally didn't expect to see anything like they saw at the top of the hill, or surely they wouldn't have investigated. And near the hilltop, the first odd thing that happened was their encountering a kind of mist or fog, which, of course, isn't too unnatural. But this involved a strange, pungent odor of some sort. I tried to get a good description of this odor, but apparently they had never smelled anything just like it before and couldn't describe it. They did all agree that it was quite irritating to their nostrils and seemed to choke them. Myself, I probably would have gone back right then. However, they didn't. Perhaps the odor wasn't too strong at that point, or they just thought the mist was ordinary fog. I don't really know. Anyway, at the top of the hill, everything really happened. And I've tried to construct this as nearly as possible, trying to figure just exactly what they did see, in what order, and so on. Of course, when you're really frightened, you don't really know everything that did happen. However, the Nunley boy did give me a very straight account, I believe, of the events as they occurred. As soon as they had reached the top of the hill, they looked down over the other side. They saw there a huge, fiery, globe-like shape. Nunley didn't know how big it was. He said, as big as a house. That's the way he described it. But let us remember that the descriptions of something seen in a few moments of fright may be quite difficult to describe correctly. Now, about the time they saw this globular shape down over the hill, they also saw something else. The Lemon boy said he thought he saw animal eyes in a tree nearby and directed his flashlight at it. And at that very moment, they became aware of a huge shape to their left, about 15 feet away. Now, this huge shape, which looked something like a man, I suppose, seemed to be moving to them, not walking, but floating, it seemed to Nunley. It also seemed to be describing an arc or moving in a circle toward them, but on an arc that would take it back down over the hill to this globe-like shape they saw. The best thing to describe this monster, as the papers called it, was that it was from 10 to 15 feet high. Its body was dark. However, Mrs. May thought she saw clothing-like folds around it. Not all of the witnesses saw this, however. Its face, if you could call it a face, was described as blood red. And out of its eyes, or eye-like openings, I imagine, seemed to project rays of light. Now, Nunley said they were greenish-orange beams. And Mrs. May, who probably was the most excited of the party, said the rays were directed right at her. But Nunley, who seemed to keep the level of head during all of this excitement, said they projected out over their heads. Now, no one knows how long they stood there watching the thing, but it must have indeed been a very short period. I suspect they took the shortest look imaginable and then took off, running as fast as they could. They don't know exactly how many seconds they watched. I don't know if such a thing freezes you there for a moment while you look at it, or whether you take the briefest glimpse and run. Anyway, this seemed to me to be something entirely alien to anyone's experience, something that would really frighten a person running onto it without any preparation. And evidently, this is how it affected these people. A funeral director, who wouldn't give me the story for fear of publicity, I suppose, happened to be around there and gave the people first aid after this experience. I understand that it made some of them quite ill. Anyway, the first thing they did was to call the sheriff. But the sheriff had already been called to another nearby town, Frametown, where a hitchhiker had got out of the car, telephoned into the county seat to the sheriff's office, said he had seen a Piper Cub plane on fire, which seemed to land on the hill. The sheriff was in Frametown investigating this particular report. However, he didn't find any evidence of any crashed aircraft, so he wasn't available to rush to Flatwoods to investigate the report he received from there about the monster. So it must have been an hour and a half later when the sheriff arrived in Flatwoods at the scene of the monster sighting. He went up onto the hilltop immediately, but he didn't find a thing. He said he couldn't smell any odor either when I asked him about the thing in his office as a part of my investigation. The first witnesses on the scene, after the people ran back down off the hill, as nearly as I can reconstruct it, were two boys, Junior Edward, about 18 years old, and a joint Martin, about 20 years old, who didn't see anything at all on the hilltop very shortly after the people had seen the monster. The next witness, as I can reconstruct, was Mr. A. Lee Stewart, who is the editor of the Braxton Democrat, another weekly newspaper of that area. He arrived, of course, checking on the thing for his paper, and decided to investigate, of course, and see if there was anything on the hilltop. The people were still quite frightened. He asked the boys to go with him to the top of the hill, and no one would accompany him at first. Finally, he talked the lemon boy into going with him, who was still cowering there and trembling, he said, still very much frightened. But this boy did go along. He walked behind Stewart, incidentally. They reached the top of the hill, and there was nothing there. which is a rather odd thing about the sighting. No one saw whatever it was leave, although perhaps it could have, and all the excitement, and no one would never have seen it. Stewart, finding nothing, however, decided to come back the next morning when it was daylight and investigate further. He was the first person on the hill the next morning. He had heard about the odor, and having had some experience with gases used in warfare, he was in the Air Force formerly, he felt that the gas may have settled to the ground, and bent to the ground and snuffed there, and he could smell the odor clinging to the ground. He said that he had never encountered any odor like that, any sort of gas that he could recognize, which was like this. He also described it as being basically irritating and a bit nauseating. He said it seemed to constrict the nasal and third passages also. He did find some peculiar markings, however, on the ground. At the place where the people had reported seeing the huge figure, he could see what he described as skid marks on the ground. These skid marks were 10 feet apart. Mr. Stewart imagined if someone were to find it possible to ride down over the hill on skis, it would leave such marks. An unusual thing about these marks was that it had merely ridden down the grass. It hadn't cut into the soil at all. The skier, if that's what it was, had merely tossed a few stones aside. Whatever it was had not been heavy in weight. A determination of these skid marks down over the hill where the people had seen the huge globular shape, a large area of grass had been trampled down. Now, some of the people around Flatwoods who didn't believe the story told me that a Mr. Brooks Fisher, who owned the farm, had been cutting hay on the side of the hill and that his tractor had left these marks. I checked immediately with Mr. Fisher and found there was nothing to this, that that part of the terrain was too steep for farm equipment, and that certainly he had not been there with any such equipment. Anyway, it all boiled down to the fact that no matter how I tried to test the thing, it appeared that this certainly was no joke or hoax, or these people certainly were not telling a fib about it all. I had come to Flatwoods quite skeptical, not wanting to believe the story in fact, and it just rather thrilled me after I had got all the facts which were within my reach. I figured that it would be almost impossible, in fact, for these people to create such a hoax, if that were what it was. As nearly as I could find out, these people had not read any science fiction. They were rather unsophisticated, I would say. Very simple country people who are usually basically honest. But perhaps, I thought, maybe someone had rigged up a monster. And they had seen that and become frightened at it. But then I thought, how could that be? This had been synchronized with a display of aerial objects over several states. That very same night, people over a wide area had seen what they variously described as shooting stars, meteorites, flying saucers going over. If someone had rigged up a stunt, it would have been too great a coincidence to have done it at the same time that all of these things were going over through the air, and especially to have one seemingly land on the hilltop just at the time this thing was cooked up. So I certainly cannot figure any way of this being a hoax. And I imagine a lot of other stories which we disbelieve would turn out to be similarly quite realistic if we had the opportunity to really investigate them instead of merely scoffing at them from a far-off vantage point. I didn't know quite how to interpret what these people had seen, and I still haven't been able to arrive at any hard and fast conclusion. I have only arrived at this conclusion, that these seven witnesses did see something that was terrifying and which was unfamiliar, something rather similar to what they described. Now, but it is the interpretation of these points that is difficult. Because of the widespread talk of and the belief in flying saucers, I was inclined to connect the incident with flying saucers. The appearance of the thing before it presumably landed was similar to many so-called flying saucers, though it did present different aspects to different viewers. The aerial object seen by Mr. Jordan and the children certainly did not behave like a meteorite. Well, if it was a flying saucer, why did it land? I asked myself, was it a mechanical difficulty? It could have been, or did its pilot wish to make observations? If this was a being which got out of a flying saucer, the hilltop would be a vantage point from where he could survey a great deal of the country. He could see a great deal from that point. And it would seem to me as if whatever it was landed on the hilltop and a creature got out of it and went to the top of the hill to see what he could see. And seeing the people coming up the hill, maybe it even was frightened of them or did not want interference. It is very hard to say. Anyway, I am convinced that the people did see something in Flatwoods, West Virginia that night in September, and that this something wasn't anything ordinary to our Earth. At least, it served to start me to thinking. Here was evidence that one would accept in a courtroom from seven witnesses. So, I was quite puzzled. Anyway, there was one thing going through my mind. But I was determined to find out more about so-called flying saucers. If there was something to this report, surely there must be something to a great many other reports. So, I suppose at that time, I got the bus.